Big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Not on strike.
Here's John Williams.
Are you? Folks are talking about that. It won't happen today. If it does, we've got about 10 more days. Actually, a couple more weeks. And we'll talk a little bit about that in this first half hour. Hi, it's John. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. Kind of a lovely day in our city. We're due for one of those. By the way, I'm due to do my Saturday show. Haven't done it in a while. We've been preempted by Northwestern football. Last couple Saturdays, you can hear me Saturdays from 10 to noon, and there we will be this Saturday. Following Saturday, we'll be at Elgin Community College for our conversation with Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Saves America, we're calling it. You got your tickets yet? Have you got your tickets yet? I know I've been bugging you about this. I wouldn't if I didn't think you would enjoy it. And if I didn't think it would be good for you, go to WGNradio.com/Teddy. Roosevelt walks onto stage with me. I talk to him. You ask him questions, too. It's always very funny. The stories are amazing. The wisdom and truth about America and the presidency and the Congress and you and me and what we should be from Roosevelt is unimpeachable. No pun intended. How do you get tickets? Go to WGNradio.com/Teddy. Go to WGNradio.com/Teddy. After the 1:30 news, we'll visit with a reporter from the Dallas Observer about the Amber Guyger conviction yesterday. Found guilty in the shooting death of Botham Jean and the dramatic hug that his brother gave to Amber Guyger. I have as much coverage as that has received questions about literally the case itself, and then we'll all talk, too, with a reporter from Dallas about that emotional moment in the courtroom as well. Could you be so forgiving? That's one of the questions people across the country are asking today. Here in Chicago, we're all paying attention to these potential strikes down the road with the Park District and the Chicago Teachers Union. They're not happy with the way the negotiations have been going on, of course, with the Chicago Public School System. On a phone line is Joanna Maldonado. She's an organizer with the Chicago Teachers Union. She's a former special ed teacher at Yates Elementary School, and she joins us on WGN. Joanna, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good. Tell me a little bit about yourself real quick. How long are you in the classroom? How long have you had a position with the union?
I was in the classroom the last 8 years, did a little bit of gen ed, bilingual ed, inclusion special ed, resource special ed, and I've been over at the union now for the last month.
What have you been doing for the union?
So getting our schools ready, right? Going out there, talking to our members, seeing how they feel about what the contract demands were, what it is that we are wanting for our schools, and what we're willing to do to get it.
Let me just read you what the Tribune said today. The city has offered 16% raises over 5 years for Chicago Public School teachers. The Chicago Teachers Union is pressuring the city for more nurses, counselors, and librarians. Wages and health care costs are the primary issue. And then they talk about a sticking point, but let's stop there. Is that your understanding as well? 16% raise over 5 years is on the table?
Yeah, that's what's on the table with an increase of health care costs in the last 2 years. I think it's also important for the city of Chicago to know that the teachers got an illegal bump in our health insurance back in the winter in January. We saw our premiums go up and our rates go up, and that is something that we're still also pushing back on. So, you know, the 16% over 5 years turns into more like 14% with the added health care costs.
You must know some people think a contract for 5 years with the 16% increase over that period of time sounds pretty good to a lot of people.
Well, we're asking for 5% for the next 3 years, and that is due to the longer school year, the longer school day that we have been working for the last 6 years. As a teacher, I had 1 year that my accountant looked at me like I was crazy, and they said, well, how are you making less 1 year than you did the previous year? And that's due to the furlough. So people need to know that we have basically had hiring salary freezes for the last 6 years.
You know, I said to some colleagues today, Joanna, that I guess I'm not surprised, but I'm angry. If every Chicago public school does not have a nurse, a counselor, and a librarian, that just seems to me to be basic. Evidently, that's not the case. It sounds like, though, the union and the school district, the schools, have said, okay, we need to do that. The way it was explained to me is that it's actually difficult to fill those positions. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's difficult to fill the positions when we know that we can't attract people to our schools if we don't have safe staffing levels for our social workers, when the only social workers that we are able to hire are based on our special education caseload. We know that all social workers in all schools help all students and not just the kids that are slated for special education services. So that's why we need a social worker, a dedicated social worker in every building. And it's based on the National Social Worker Association numbers. You know, they require 250 for one social worker in an area that doesn't have high level of trauma. And we know in parts of our city, we need vastly more wraparound services than what we are currently providing.
I guess all the schools don't have a librarian. Do you share then a librarian? Somebody's there Monday and Tuesday, and then they're at another school Wednesday and Thursday. Is that how it goes?
Oh, no. So there's about 100 schools that have a dedicated librarian. All other schools, including Northside College Prep, which is one of the top revered schools in the country, don't have a librarian. And I don't think people know that, you know. And so it's not that those positions aren't shared. Those are positions that those schools, principals, LSCs have really valued and were able to keep in their budgets or get additional funding from fundraising or whatever. But 500 of our schools do not have librarians in them, and we have empty libraries that are being used for storage, pile desks in.
Tell me if I'm wrong about this. The money is budgeted for those. They literally can't fill those positions. True or false?
False. When I started teaching 8 years ago, every school I knew had a librarian. All librarians are certified teaching personnel. So when decisions were made at my school 3 years ago to cut the librarian, they put that teacher into a primary classroom. And that's not what he went to back to school to get certified to be a librarian to do. So he had to, and he even offered to do a half-time library position to keep the library open, and that didn't happen. So, and the principal didn't budget for it.
Yeah,
so he
right.
had to go to another school to do that.
So that's made at the local level. The principals are using the money that way. They'd rather have another teacher in the classroom than a librarian in the school.
Well, they're forced to do that based on student-based budgeting.
It was also explained to me that the median salary for teachers with this contract will approach $100,000 a year.
That's funny. It's funny. As an eighth-year teacher, that's not what I would be making, and it's not something that's viable. I feel that people need to know that we have steps and lanes in our contract. Those were things that we've already gone on strike for, we've already fought for, we've already won. And that basically is based on years of experience and years of education. We are required to go back to school to continue keeping our certification up. And so that's what we do. And we have the most nationally board certified teachers in the country in the city. And those people are being, it's now being used against them because now they're too quote unquote expensive. And people, principals are looking for younger, cheaper teachers that are able to fit their budgeting model based on the number of students in the school.
I understand that, but I don't know that that makes what I said not true. There will be a lot of six-figure teachers if this contract goes into place.
I mean, with the amount of work that teachers are required to do, I'm not going to be one to apologize. And if we need to, we should be paying all teachers $100,000 a year.
Yeah. If we can afford it, I don't think you get any argument from many people. But if I were to earn $100,000 a year to teach, I think a lot of people would say I would take that deal. The average household income is about $63,000.
Well, I know teachers that were getting close to that, and they left the classroom and did early retirement or left the career together entirely because what we're asked to do with 35 kids in the classroom, with no social worker in the building, with all of this pressure around testing, that it is, you know, to me, the money wouldn't be worth it if I'm not actually there to do what I set out to do as a teacher, yeah, which is to educate and inspire.
I want to read you another sentence in the Chicago Tribune dated Wednesday. The sticking point appears to center on class sizes and the union's desire for more nurses, social workers, and librarians. CPS said They've committed to adding more of those positions, but the union wants it in writing in their contract. It's been explained to me that this has been promised forever, but it's not happened. So if we can get it in writing, we'll feel better about filling these positions. Would you comment on that?
I think folks need to also know that 4.5 in the labor law makes these things permissible to bargain around and make demands around, but that law was specifically created and only applies to Chicago Public Schools. And so everyone else can bargain around these issues and be a collective bargaining agreement, but for us, it's just a demand. And so right now, there are students, when there's 34 students in the classroom, I just spoke to a mom half an hour ago where her son is getting in trouble because there's so many kids in a second grade classroom. And a kid that doesn't get in trouble unless that if they're in a learning environment that's conducive to learning. But when you have 34 kids that are 7, 8 years old in the classroom with one teacher in there, that is not an environment where the students are feeling like they're there to learn and the teacher's there to teach.
I want to play for you a clip from a podcast that we recorded here today at WGN Radio. There were some journalists in who have been following this story, and we're all just, to be honest with you, on the outside looking in. It's so much to get our heads around. I don't know what it's like in the classroom. I don't know what the actual dollars and cents, responsibilities, or pressures are. I think like a lot of parents or people who don't even have kids in the school, you hate to see it come to this. And the numbers, and I don't know which side to pick. Let's put it that way. I don't know who should compromise more for whom. I really don't. So I don't have a dog in this hunt. This is one of the points, though, that was made in our podcast conversation today. I'll play for you a clip of it. There are two voices. One is Austin Berg. He's with the Illinois Policy Institute. The other is Heather Sharon. She's a reporter and editor at a news source called The Daily Line. They were talking about the negotiations. I think the first voice we'll hear is Heather's.
Now CTU is saying with these demands would cost the average property taxpayer an additional $220 a year, every Chicago homeowner. And at the end of the day, I agree, it's completely tone deaf. They are throwing the lives of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people into chaos to make a political point. And that is made especially clear by the fact that this was coordinated by the Park District, who in the last big 2012 strike provided services for kids who couldn't go to school. And now they're going to be gone too. That's a serious issue, and I think it's a moral issue more than a tax
issue. Do you think
this
is being orchestrated by these players because they wanted Preckwinkle? They don't like Lightfoot?
Sure, I think that's part of it. When Rahm Emanuel announced he wasn't running for a third term, CTU declared victory. We pushed him out of office, and now we will pick the next mayor. And that did not happen. And there's no doubt a good deal of hurt feelings and bad blood between CTU and Mayor Lightfoot because they see her as somebody who ran on the platform that they created and has yet to fulfill those promises. I will say on the money, CPS now has roughly over the last 2 years about $1 billion more. And the teacher's argument is let's put that money in the classroom and reverse those cuts, those, you know, years of austerity under Rahm Emanuel. Because let's not forget, you know, Bruce Rauner in 2016, 2017 was suggesting that CPS should declare bankruptcy.
Years of austerity, though, is a total, if you look at spending per student over the last 10 years, it goes up every single year. It's about $17,000 per student now. And the idea that CPS has all this extra money lying around, I think, is also a dangerous idea. It's a junk-rated school district. They don't
that's
have extra,
that's,
extra
that's
money lying
true.
Around at all.
Okay, so that's Austin Berg, and that's Heather Sharon in the Mincing Rascals podcast, which goes up later today. On a phone line is Joanna Maldonado. She's an organizer with the Chicago Teachers Union. So there's a lot there for you. What do you want to talk about first there, Joanna?
Well, I want to address the fact that some folks feel that they don't have a dog in this hunt. And I think that we all do. And anybody who is paying rent to a landlord and any homeowner that is paying into that is paying taxes that is going directly to the schools, everyone has an interest in this. We also know that we increase spending on police in this city and in other things that like our first responders, when we know that the best thing to do is treat things at its root issues and causes. And if we have schools that are safely staffed, that have social workers, that have counselors, that have teachers that can meet the needs of their students, that we're automatically decreasing future costs in the future and making our state, our city safer and our schools places where people want to send their kids to schools. There is a lot of property owners that are sending their kids to private schools. That is costing them a lot of money when they're already paying taxes, and that money should be going into the public school so everyone can go to their neighborhood school. We also, as not, this is not a singular platform. This is a platform that says we also need to talk about progressive revenue. We also need to be sure that we are taxing the rich, because there is money in this town and nobody can convince me that we don't have any money to pay for these things. And why is it that people are moving and send their kids and go to Skokie and Evanston and Schaumburg, which are nearby areas? Why do folks have to move in order to get a quality education when we live in a world-class city? And, you know, this whole idea that this is a political thing, I mean, we know that Lori won in every single ward. We are just holding her to her promises to be a transformative mayor that was going to do things differently, and we are just holding her accountable as we should be in a democracy.
That may be the soundbite right there, though. I mean, is that what this is? Lori has not been quick enough or thorough enough in her promises. And that's what it's all about, because it sounds like the two sides aren't that far apart on some of these financial issues. You want assurances, the money's on the table. Yeah, you got to pay a little more for health care, join the club. But it sounds like it's about control and about who's the mayor. No?
It's about getting the things that we need in our schools that she promised and agrees with. All we want is that this gets codified into language, that next year we know that these aren't the first positions that are going to get cut. We know how this works, and we know what we need to do. We have money coming in from the state. We have the ability to do progressive revenue ideas now with the new mayor, and we have the ability to staff our schools where everybody can send their kids
would
to their local neighborhood school.
Pardon me, would you also respond to the suggestion by one of the other voices in that clip that coordinating with the park district so as to ace out families completely is almost a moral issue? That really is going to throw hundreds of thousands of families into turmoil. What's the obligation of the teachers to that?
The city of Chicago is throwing thousands of families into turmoil every day by having schools unsafely staffed, by not providing the services that we know schools need and deserve. And so it is a moral issue that she do what she is promising and put it in writing, because the city has said enough is enough.
On a phone line is Joanna Maldonado from the Chicago Teachers Union. A couple of questions and comments from our listeners, and then Joanna, will let you go, but I appreciate your time and thoughts on all of this. Hey, Scott, you're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Yeah, I am definitely biased. I am pro-union. I am completely pro-teacher. What I wanted to ask your guests is to give Chicago a scenario of what Chicago public schools would be like if we eliminated the unions completely.
You have a response to that, Joanna?
I mean, every clinician that just, we had 1,000 new teachers sign up this year. We have, a couple of hundred of new clinicians, and we did not walk out of that room without union cards. This is an option, and this is an option that everyone that works in Chicago Public Schools knows that we have to take. People do not feel like they can trust Chicago Public Schools. It is a lot of dog and pony shows, and we know that those of us in the classroom every day know what our students need to be successful. So I can't even imagine what the city would look like. New Orleans has 100% charter schools, and they still have the same problems. We need a union that has the fight in them to demand the things that our students deserve.
Jen DeSalvo, what are you thinking about over there?
Well, I do have a question, because I keep hearing this $100,000 number thrown around. So I understand that there's steps and lanes for teachers. How many teachers realistically make over $100,000 a year? Because I wasn't under the impression that the steps and lanes for the actual teachers in the classrooms reached even $100,000 with experience. So how accurate is that number while we're reporting this?
I said median, maybe it's average, but that's the number I'm hearing. Go ahead, Joanna.
And that is what, when I looked at the contract, teachers that have been working for 30 plus years can make with doctorates, and then there is a cap, right? For the last 6 years, we've had a freeze on teacher wages that have been teachers who are in year 14, 15, 16, 17 of their teaching experience. They've been frozen at the same salary. The median income for somebody starting out of school is about $50,000. How you're going to go from $50,000 to $100,000 in a matter of 5 years, that math just doesn't make any sense to me.
On the phone line is Paul. You're on WGN. Paul, what did you want to say?
I think a lot of the people, I believe, number one, Chicago teachers are among the highest paid in the nation. The school system itself is not ranked anywhere near the highest in the nation. I understand a lot of it is really social problems. As far as teachers retiring well into their careers, they retire, and I know many of them, because the pension is so good. Not because really they want to teach any longer. And that's the position the teachers are in. And everybody should make as much money as possible. But a teacher starting at $50,000, John, I'd like to know if you or one of your staff can tell me what a starting police officer makes and what a starting fireman makes.
Can you? Do you have that? Do you know, Paul?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'll look it up. Thank you for your call and your comment, and I'll let her respond, and then we're done. Go ahead, Joanna. You're on the air.
I know they make about double what we make as a starting salary. I mean, I don't. I'll let you go ahead and report and research on what that looks like.
Okay, and I think his other point was, though, whatever the economics are for teachers salary-wise, the pension is so generous that that's in the back of a lot of people's minds, too, Joanna.
I mean, right now I'm not even invested in my pension. I've been teaching for 8 years, and if I walked away from teaching and didn't go into the classroom, I get nothing. So that was something that was done in the 2016 contract. We have a second tier for pensions. We don't get Social Security. We pay into our pensions. This was a decision that was made long before us by one of the dailies. And if that's something that needs to be reversed, that's a state issue. At this point, what we're talking about is pensions are promises. We don't have Social Security, and that is the only thing that we have.
It would require amending the Constitution to change the pension formula, and I do think that point does not get made often enough, that the rest of us do have Social Security to fall back on. Teachers do not. So whatever the teacher pension is, and maybe we promised too much. I happen to believe that we did. I wish somebody promised me too much. But whatever we promised them, they don't get Social Security. So subtract that before you decide how generous it is. Okay.
My last point is that we want folks to know that the things that we can strike over are salary and benefits and working conditions. What we also want to negotiate is classroom sizes, the way that the Illinois Education Task Force came up with an evidence-based funding formula that funds smaller classroom sizes, fully staffed bilingual education, and English language learners. It is evidence-based that if we give students and schools the structure to succeed, they will. And we want that in writing.
Nice to talk to you today, Joanna. Good luck to you. Good luck to the parents and students, to the CTU, to the Chicago Public School System as well. I hope we get this resolved and don't go on strike. I appreciate you joining us.
Hope so, too. Thank you.
Ella, our producer, somebody called in or texted in, and they said, step one, Chicago firefighters, what's the pay that those people get?
Around $56,000.
$56,000. I'm looking at Wikipedia about the Chicago Police Department. It says starting salary for Chicago police officers. We're talking about this only because some people were cross-referencing what Chicago public school teachers make relative to, say, first responders, firefighters, cops. Starting salary for Chicago police officers in 2016, according to Wikipedia, is $48,000, increased to $72,500 after 18 months. That was 2 or 3 years ago. And then there's additional pay if you move up the rank ladder. They also had interesting, I thought, the demographics. 50% of the Chicago police force, non-Hispanic white, 25% Hispanic, 21% African-American, I would have guessed higher, and 3% Asian-American, Pacific Islander, 1% other. In terms of gender, I saw it, and now it seems to escape me. No, there it is. 77% of the Chicago police force is male, 23% is female. Steve, you know how we've taken to, at the end of the 1:30 newscast, playing back a highlight from a previous day's show?
Yes.
Sometimes it's something funny, sometimes it's something thoughtful or controversial, but every now and then, we know you can't listen every day, every minute, we replay a little bit, and we've been doing that at 1:30. Yesterday, while you were away, we played the previous day's end of the news. This would be a good time to go ahead and guess a temperature, don't you think?
Yeah, so Lake Michigan water temperature
is... it was 59. We've had winds from the north. It's 85, 87, 86. Stand by. 61, final answer.
Do you promise this is the last time we'll do this?
What is the water temperature, please?
61 degrees.
Booyah!
I'm Steve Bertrand in the WG newsroom, and most of these are the stories that matter.
It's a gift.
On 720 WG.
Just thought you might want to hear that again.
Bad enough to live it once, really.
It's an unusual talent that evidently I don't know how I developed it, but somehow I'm able to guess temperatures and other meteorological readings, including water temperature, given just the tiniest amount of data. I'm like a human weather station. I can't explain it. In the 2 o'clock hour, we have to do this. Yesterday, we spent a lot of time talking about why people are leaving Illinois. A couple of reporters from the Tribune were in this studio, and they talked about the exodus that we have. In fact, the title of the series is called Illinois Exodus, and it was depressing. After 2 o'clock, what you like about living in Chicago and or Illinois. What you like about living in Chicago and or Illinois. We need to do that as a balm to yesterday's show, and we will at 2:10. Boy, I hope someone calls. You got a half an hour. Google it. There's got to be something. For crying out loud. It was taxes. It was corruption. It was crime. It was the weather. People were calling in from Nashville going, na-na-na, boo-boo. We need to know why we're here, and let's enjoy it. Let's celebrate it. Let's list it after the 2:10, after the 2 o'clock news around 2:10. So the whole country yesterday saw and or shared the video of Botham Jean's brother hugging Amber Geiger. She's that police officer in Texas who shot and killed this man named Botham Jean. And her defense was that she thought she was in her apartment, that he was there. She fired upon this gentleman and killed him. I have a lot of questions about that story. But what was noteworthy then was at the sentencing, his brother said that I forgive her. In fact, part of that audio goes like this.
I forgive you. And I know if you go to God and ask him, he will forgive you. Again, I'm speaking for myself, not even bad for my family. But I love you just like anyone else. And I personally want the best for you. And I wasn't gonna ever say this in front of my family or anyone, but I don't even want you to go to jail because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please?
And then he did. The judge broke down in tears, and you could hear, it was audible, the cries in the gallery as people were watching this scene surprisingly play out in front of everybody. A reporter in Dallas is Stephen Young, and he joins us now on WGN Radio. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are y'all doing?
Real well, thank you. You're with the Dallas Observer. What's the reaction been? They're in the newsroom, they're in Dallas. How are people reacting to that scene today?
I think the consensus about Brant Jean's embrace of Amber Geiger yesterday is just that he showed incredible grace during what has to be, you know, if not the most, one of the most trying times of his life yesterday. Everyone's been very impressed with him, and, you know, throughout the year since this shooting, very impressed with Botham Jean's family in general. There has been some reaction, especially among the activist community, that feels the sentence given to Ms. Geiger was too short. But everyone's kind of amazed by what they saw in the courtroom yesterday.
Let's go back and tell the story of the shooting. What happened?
In broad strokes, this happened about a year ago on September 6, 2018. Amber Geiger, who was at that point a Dallas police officer, got off work at about 9:30. She drove home to her apartment complex, which is located just south of downtown Dallas. She drove her pickup truck up to the fourth floor of the parking garage of the apartment complex. When she lived on the third floor, and that's kind of the critical mistake that sets all this off. She got out of her truck on the fourth floor and walked to what would have been her apartment, had she been on the third floor, which was Mr. Jean's apartment. She heard, movement inside the apartment, thought it was a burglar, pushed the door open, which was unlocked, and, fired two shots, one of which hit Botham Jean directly in the heart, and from the medical testimony, it seems like it killed him almost instantly. And so she was initially charged with manslaughter 3 days after the shooting, and then a Dallas County grand jury indicted her for murder this winter, and her week and a half trial just concluded this week.
Why did they upgrade the charge? It seems to me like it was a mistake on her part.
Well, in Texas law, to be charged with manslaughter, you have to have done something reckless. Like if, for instance, she had fired through the apartment door, not knowing if anyone was inside and hit him, then that would have been an appropriate manslaughter charge. In this case, you know, whether she made a mistake or not, I mean, the consensus is she did make a mistake. When she pointed her gun and shot Mr. Jean, she did so on purpose, and that's murder under Texas law. I mean, even during her own testimony on the stand, she admitted that she intentionally shot Botham Jean and intended to kill him. And yeah. That's murder. So
that's interesting. Had she been more reckless, if you will, which you generally don't want anybody to be with a gun, but if she had been more reckless, then maybe she would have had an opportunity to not be convicted of murder charges?
I mean, if she had shot through the door or something like that and recklessly caused someone's death, then yeah, she could have been convicted on manslaughter charges. But
well, there was no history between her and Jean, right? I mean, it was...
No, not at all. They, as far as anyone knows, had never met before.
So she has no motivation to kill him other than mistaken identity. She thought that was her apartment and that gentleman is standing there. Was he coming at her? Was her life in danger in that instant?
I don't think her life was in danger at that instant. There's some dispute as to whether he was coming at her, whether he had reacted, you know, as any of us might, if someone had burst into our apartment and pointing a gun at us. Her defense team argued that he was coming at her, and she did fear for her life. But, you know, he had no weapons. You know, he didn't even have pockets in the shorts he was wearing. So it's kind of hard to imagine how he would have had a weapon. To your point, the defense, her defense team raised what's known in Texas as a mistake of fact defense, that she made two mistakes that led to Mr. Jean's death, both believing it was her apartment and then believing that he was an intruder. But under Texas law, for a defendant to be found not guilty based on mistake of fact, the jury has to decide those mistakes were reasonable, and in this case they decided the mistakes were unreasonable.
Well, it's quite a tragedy, but it just seems to me like something's wrong here, either in the law or in the crime she was charged with. And not to diminish the tragedy for Jean's family, but you're treating her like somebody who, you know, some gangbanger who's got a grudge and shoots and kills somebody. That's not what this was. She did not intend to, it was not her plan that day to seek this man out and shoot and kill him. It was a mistake. I, my language fails me here, but it seems to me like this is not what I have in mind when I think of somebody guilty of murder. You know what I mean, Stephen?
I do know what you mean, and I think the jury considered that in their sentence. You know, the jury could have given her anywhere between 5 and 99 years, yeah, and gave her 10 years, which, you know, is a sentence that she also very well could have gotten had she been convicted of manslaughter. Manslaughter in Texas carries a sentence of between 2 and 20 years. So, you know, the difference between murder and manslaughter here isn't necessarily a difference in how much time she's going to serve. It's more of a difference of the shooting and the act that actually happened.
How aware should she have been that she was not in the right apartment, not on the right floor? Didn't the floor mat or some decoration on the door not match the floor mat or the decoration in her apartment? Should she not have been more aware at that time?
I think that's definitely something that prosecutors wanted the jury to consider, you know, going to whether her mistake was in mistaking the apartment was reasonable or not. Botham Jean did have a bright red doormat that she did not have. And, you know, there were other features of the hallway that were different on the fourth floor than the third floor. But, you know, the floor plans of the hallways are identical. I think the biggest thing for a lot of people watching the trial, I mean, I can't speak for the jury, is when, you know, she said she heard movement inside the apartment and then decided to go in anyway.
Right.
I think that was big for a lot of people because she very easily could have, or I don't want to say easily, that may be being a bit glib, but she could have, you know, gone back into the hallway and taking cover, or, you know, this apartment building is less than half a mile from Dallas's police headquarters. She could have used her police radio and had, you know, dozens of officers worth of backup in less than 2 minutes, probably. So it was that decision to go inside that it seemed like really affected public opinion on the case, at least during the trial.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm just trying to think of how many times listeners to this conversation right now have themselves gotten into the wrong car or walked into the wrong building or walked into the wrong room or home. I wonder if people go, I can understand that mistake, at least. Firing a gun is another element, but how many of us have walked into a unit that wasn't our own? I don't know the answer to that. Stephen, if you have one more minute, I'll take it. Stephen Young, reporter for the Dallas Observer on WGN. We're wrapping up a conversation with Stephen Young, a reporter for the Dallas Observer. We're talking about Amber Geiger's shooting and murder conviction of that man, Botham Jean. And, you know, I'm wondering now, you said 10 years, Stephen. I've just got a minute left, but how long will she go to jail? If it's 10 years, when will she get out?
She has to do a minimum of 5 in Texas. She'll be eligible for parole once she served half her sentence.
Watching that hug, it seems so strong and long between her and his brother, as though, I don't know, she were relieved or certainly appreciated that opportunity, didn't she?
Yeah, there was definitely, I would call it almost a sense of absolution about that hug, at least between the family, Mr. Jean's family and Amber Geiger. I don't know about the rest of the community in Dallas, but it seems like there's definitely been a significant degree of forgiveness from the Jean family to Amber Geiger.
I appreciate your time today, Stephen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Young with the Dallas Observer.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
Well,
here's John Williams.
We roll all the way until 3 on the John Williams Show. We appreciate you tuning in. Remember, the number to call or text is 312-981-7200. We do read your texts if they agree with the host. Well, if we said we were going to give away tickets to the Teddy Roosevelt Show, you need to call or text 312-981-7200. And the 10th person, I don't know how Elif does this, will get a pair of tickets to go see our Teddy Roosevelt Show. A pair of tickets to see TR on stage with me. That'll be not this Saturday, but the following Saturday. It'll be at the Elgin Community College, and you'll love this, Steve Bertrand, Blizzard Theater. You get it? Blizzard, really cold, Blizzard.
I got it. By the way, if I may, put Kim Gordon on the list of those who enjoy the burning dust smell.
This is not a thing.
I'm not alone.
This is not a thing. I thought you're crazy, man. What are you even talking about?
I thought you were going the other way with it, though. Like that you like to be there to make sure your house isn't burning down the first time you turn
it on. That would have been the way to roll.
Because that's how I roll.
It's a whiff you only get once a year.
I also wanted to mention this. You know, we were visiting with that reporter a little while ago. We were talking about the story of Amber Geiger's conviction of murdering Botham Jean. And I said, I don't know if people have had that experience where they walk into the wrong house, car, apartment, whatever. And by the way, I'll have caller number 10, we said. I'm getting texts like that. 708 says, John, I walked into the wrong car once, the wrong apartment once, the wrong house once. I went all the way into the kitchen, and I consider myself to be a careful person. San Antonio, Texas, texted in and said, I live in a furnished apartment near Lackland Air Force Base. All apartments were identical. The same furniture, same colors, same floor plans. I guess the point being that, yeah, that can happen. Somebody could make that mistake. She drove to the wrong floor in the parking deck, and then everything else would have been the same until she got into her apartment, saw a man, and fired. I didn't ask the guest about the castle doctrine. If you are in your house and somebody breaks in a lot of states you have the right to shoot that person if you feel that you're in danger. But what if you are accidentally breaking into somebody else's place? Is it still the same principle? You feel you're in danger? A couple of you have reminded me, too, that cops don't, run and call for reinforcements. If they feel there's an intruder, that's the direction they go. Their training is to approach that dangerous situation where the inclination for the rest of us might have been to go the other way. I've gotten in the wrong car before. And last year, after a Blackhawks game, there were people in my car. They were sitting in my car. I came up and go, yeah. This ain't working, Jack. They were so embarrassed, they didn't even make eye contact.
How'd they get in your car?
I used the fob to open it up in advance.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm out in the sea of cars, and I just go, boop, boop.
Yeah.
And that opens the door, but it also, the lights go, and I know where my car is.
Exactly, yeah.
And these people have one like mine, and we're in that same area, and they go, oh, there it is.
Oh, man.
And they walked right in. A few of you just... If I may digress for one moment, said, listen, when you're in that situation, John, don't unlock your car. Lock your car. The lights will still go off. In fact, if you do it twice, in my case, the horn honks. So you can find your car by locking it rather than unlocking it. And I never thought to do that. Silly me, huh? Okay. Steve, you weren't here yesterday. Jen was here, and we spent some time with a couple reporters from the Tribune. And they were talking about the Illinois exodus. Did you hear that conversation?
I did not.
If you did, you know that we literally, Elif was typing up or cutting and pasting the texts as they were coming in and handing them to me. She gave me 18 sheets of paper. And people, if I had to categorize them, I would say taxes was the number one reason you're leaving. Cost of living of a house. You can get a mortgage cheaper in Tennessee than you can here. You don't get as good of schools as you do in the Chicago area, but, pick your poison. A lot of you were just burdened with the corruption. You're tired of the politics of the city and the state. I don't know that anybody moves for that reason, but when you leave, you're glad to be away from it. Let's say that. But when I got home last night, I was not feeling good about the city that I know and love. I was born here. I said, we need to fix that. So we texted out and tweeted out, and I'm asking right now for you to call in 312-981-7200. And we already have the winner for the Teddy Roosevelt tickets. Thank you very much. Don't call in for the Teddy Roosevelt tickets. You can get them by going to WGNradio.com/Teddy and see us next Saturday. We've already got our winner. We'll do it again tomorrow. But call or text now and just give me something. Let's feel good about Chicago. This shouldn't be very complicated, right? Boom, something you love about the city. Go. Somebody call. Actually, we have a lot of calls and texts. So we'll get started on this now. You need to be part of it. You can text or call 312-981-7200. We kicked ourselves in the rear end yesterday. Obviously, having five sports franchises and a Big Ten team in our city, plus a Big East team, if you include DePaul, I think we have a great sports culture in the city. It'd be nice if more of our teams won. But if you're a sports fan, and I'm not a big sports fan, but I like living in a town that has a great, vigorous sports culture, this is one of those. It's a world-class city. And again, if you're listening to me in Naperville, you're not downtown as often as I am. You don't walk by Millennium Park all the time. You don't see the museum campus often on your drive. But I do, and it's lovely. And the times that you do drive up and down Lakeshore Drive and you see Lake Michigan and the city to the west, there just aren't many places in America, in the world, that have as beautiful a skyline and waterfront as we do. If you don't use that but a couple times a year, I hope it's good to know that you live near that and that you have access to it. And when you do, you got to admit, it's a beautiful city. Okay, that's two. 312-981-7200. Things big or small. Ricky, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Did you say Ricky?
Yeah, I sure did.
Oh, I'm here. All right, John, let me preface yesterday's comment. I got three quick things. Okay. First of all, yesterday, you don't have to leave. If you like it here, you don't have to leave because of property taxes. I live in the city, been in my house over 30 years, nice neighborhood on the edge. My property tax, always reasonable, a little over $4,000 a year.
Yeah.
Okay, that's that. As far as the city, I think we're the best city in the country. We have more than any other place except New York, maybe, but it's easier to negotiate. We have Lake Michigan. We can get around the whole country and, you know, Canada centrally located. If you'd let me address just one more thing, I'm a retired teacher, 36 years classroom, and I want to say two things. As far as the Chicago demands, I think low class size should be at the top of their list. For preschool up through four, if you can have low, you can get the kids' skills up to par so that when they go into fifth and later, you don't need the low class size anymore. And one more thing, I taught in South Berwyn most of my career, elementary. We never had certified librarians. I don't believe you need them. We had people with two-year college degrees that manned the libraries just fine.
You're a terrific call, Ricky. I need to hear from you more often.
Thank you, John. I'll do it.
Have a good day now. It's 2:16. We go from Ricky to who's next here? Ed, you're on WGN. Good things about living in Chicago and or Illinois. Go.
One of the great things I think about living here is it's close to Wisconsin.
Is that a backhanded compliment? Is that actually because Wisconsin is better?
It's just easier to get to Wisconsin from here. It's the Lake Geneva.
All right. Thanks for the phone call. Well, I guess that's true. I'm looking for sincere ones, but I'll take what I can get. Mark, you're on WGN. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, King John, I just love all the microbreweries in the Chicagoland area. I mean, Goose Island downtown is nationally known, but little places like in Schiller Park and in Oswego have these little microbreweries. Great, great, great craft beer. And the second item is Joe Davies County is a treasure. Yeah. My family has a home out there. It's beautiful all year round, and really it's only a two-hour drive from Chicago, and it's just beautiful, but that's what I like best.
Well put. I'm glad you called. Every city in America now brags about their breweries and their microbrews, and everybody gets to have that. But you got to admit, Chicago kind of rocks the world in that category. And I'll put this in there, too. More and more distilleries in the Chicago area as well. You know, that Whiskey Acres that we've talked to on this show, Rokan had them on as well.
I love that smell. That's another smell. I love that smell.
They make some good stuff. They're in DeKalb. They grow their own corn to distill to make their own whiskey and bourbon. And this is, I'm not exactly sure how this goes, Steve, but this is what they do. They either take a maple syrup barrels, and then they put the whiskey in there and age it, so you get kind of a maple-y bourbon, if you want that. But then they also take the bourbon and whiskey barrels, and they give them to a syrup maker, and then they make a syrup with kind of a smoky, bourbon-y feel. So I have both the bourbon-flavored syrup, and I have the syrup-flavored bourbon. And those will rock your world.
And so then you gave me, or they gave, well, you gave me those wood chips or the shredded barrels.
And then they take the chips.
For Lou, yeah, to give to Lou.
And you can put them in like your smoker.
Right. And just if just to take a whiff of the bag, it's, well, it's better than that burning dust smell in
it's
the
really
beginning
a wonderful
of winter.
Thing, yeah. And that place is in DeKalb. And if you just Google Whiskey Acres, you'll see what I'm talking about. Some of that stuff is limited batch, but good for them, huh? Let's see here. Amy, you're on WGN Radio. Thanks for calling in, Amy. What can I do for you?
Hi, John. I was listening, and I wanted to say one of my favorite things is something called the Teen Arts Pass. And what this is it is a pass that is available to any teen between the ages of 13 and 19 for free that allows them to go and see many different theater plays in Chicago and some surrounding suburbs for only $5. They can also bring a companion with them to many shows, like a parent or a
nice
sibling or friend, for $5. We just saw, my son and I just saw The Barber of Seville last night at the Lyric Opera. They are part of it.
Wow.
And it was the one. Yes, exactly.
That's big
and
time.
It is. They have many theaters, not all, but many, and it's been wonderful. And I'm singing it from the rooftops because it's fantastic.
I'm so glad you did. Thank you, Amy.
You're welcome.
I'm going from you to Frank. You're on WGN Radio. Frank, what did you want to say?
John, three things about Chicago that I enjoy. The journalists that are associated with all the media profiles in Chicago, the hardworking people, the hardworking people in addition to our politeness from the Midwest and our skyline. But a question I'd like to ask would be, why are we highlighting the good things of Chicago when I feel that a lot of times the bad things really outweigh the good things, and we have to remind ourselves the good things of Chicago to be proud to be an Illinoisan or to be a Chicagoan, to stay in this state when so many people are leaving for obvious reasons?
Yeah. You get the feeling we're kind of on the knife's edge right now, and I'm trying to remind us of some of the good stuff because it sure is easy to find the bad stuff. And
but we should be focusing on correcting the things that are wrong, that have been wrong for so many years, which on certain issues we should be down at City Hall with pitchforks and torches because this is getting out of control. Many politicians, their benefits don't freeze. They continue to rise. So all these politicians and governments have to find new ways to generate revenue so they can support politicians' salaries and benefits, because look what's happening with our teachers. They have to scrounge to find money to increase their salaries. But politicians, their salaries never freeze.
Is it this way in other states? Do you think it's this way in other states? If I was doing this in Pennsylvania or Arkansas or Ohio, would people be as distraught with the state and city politicians as we are in Chicago and Illinois? I don't know.
Last year, the state of Wisconsin had a tax-free weekend prior to the kids going back to school because the state of Wisconsin recognized that the cost of getting kids back to school with school supplies and clothes, and they issued a tax-free weekend because there was a surplus in their budget. When was the last time Chicago ever had a surplus in any sector of government?
I'm glad you called, Frank. I'm hanging up now.
All right.
Bye now. By the way, he said the first thing he said was he likes the media profile in this town. As you listen to WGN Radio in Chicago, remember, this is a city with two daily newspapers and some pretty damn good suburban newspapers and some pretty excellent, the Daily Line, ProPublica, some amazing local websites, to say nothing of the likes of WGN Radio. I think we're in that mix. It's a good, vigorous newspaper and media town, that's for sure. 517 texted in and said, I was having a bad day, and John Williams just made me laugh out loud. Thank you for helping me find my bright side. I don't know what it was. I hope it was something I did on purpose. Steve, many, many, many texts like this. That smell is just like burning leaves when your furnace first cranks up.
See that?
708. to Steve Bertrand. Me too. I sold my parents' house this year, and I guess I won't be able to smell that first crank of the furnace and the dust burning again. I miss that smell. 815, I'm with Steve Bertrand. Love the smell of the furnace. Another 815-er, I'm so with Steve Bertrand on the burning dust smell. Chilly, cozy, comfy Bernie, says Genesis and Joliet. 630, I'm with Steve, yay. And finally, 219, I live in Indiana. I work in Yorkville, Illinois. I can't stand either state. I hate the weather here. I'm moving to Nashville. So just a few of the texts which have poured in. We asked you to tell us some good news in your world. That is, tell us something that's good about living in this area. And lots of texts are still coming in and calls as well. Janet, you wanted to say what? You're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to say, speaking of smells, who else has a chocolate factory downtown that you get to smell as you go down there?
Yes.
Also, the zoo. The zoo is free, and you get to know all the animals. And I've been here since Edgewater Beach Hotel was not on Lakeshore Drive. We used to play on the beach there with the water coming up. And it's Lakeshore Drive going downtown from the north side. Is I don't know about the south side. I haven't gone that way, but it is just beautiful. And the growth of Chicago. I went down last week. Hadn't been there in like 20 years. I live in the suburbs. I could not believe the Lakeshore Drive, when you get off it, it just keeps, you can go underneath the city. It's wonderful. It's a thriving, it's a thriving city.
Yeah. And you know, we didn't even mention the river. I mean, what they have done with the river alone is a reason to put this in a special category, the city of Chicago. Lots more texts. We'll post them on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John, just as a nice category of it, because that's kind of nice to see. And we're out of time. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. Music for a reason after the 2:30 news featuring producer Elif Garris. What are you playing for us, Elif?
This woman who is just a girl turned 50 today, Gwen Stefani.
How about that?
Who most of us know her since No Doubt.
She's 50 today?
She's 50. She doesn't look like it. I related to this song so much.
This is one of the songs you rocked out to as a kid?
Yeah.
Are you going to rock out to The Joker? So that movie opens up tomorrow. Be interesting to see how it does. Hasn't hurt for lack of publicity. It's interesting. Richard Roper heard on Rokan's show and in the Sun-Times today gave it 3.5 stars. Michael Phillips in the Chicago Tribune gave it 1.5 stars. I saw Dean Richards on Channel 9 today, and you'll hear his review on Sunday morning as well. I think he reviews it probably on Cochrane's show tomorrow and then on TV as well. Dean Richards said that this is as difficult to write a review as he's ever written, or something like that. He didn't tip his hand today as to how he's going to review the movie that opens tomorrow, The Joker. I love that character. I think it's fascinating and creepy and scary, and the whole thing works for me as a dose in a Batman movie. But 2+ hours of that, I don't want to do. You know what I mean?
My husband asked if I wanted to go with him and his bestie this weekend to see it, and I was like, nope.
I mean, it's fascinating. Like, I even like the trailer pretty much, but you go, do you want to do that for 2 hours? And I think, no.
Yeah, and Joaquin Phoenix is great.
I know, that's the thing. I'm like, I really want to see that. But I just don't know if I want to see that much of that, right? So that's, I may change my mind on it, but right now I'm not going to be there this weekend. Jason Nathanson, the entertainment reporter for ABC, has seen it, if I'm not mistaken. Jason, how are you today?
I'm good. Yes, I have seen the movie.
All right. Have you given your official review? Can you tell us what you thought of it?
I can tell you what I thought of it, and I think it is a fantastic movie coming at a weird time in society that's going to color everything about it. So it depends on how you see the world, how you view things, what kind of characters you want to see right now. This might not be the movie for you if you're fed up with society, you're fed up with violence, you're fed up with these kinds of stories of, you know, white men doing violence on society and these kind of outcasts who have been stepped on or view themselves as stepped on and turning violent because of that. I get that criticism of the film. Just as a movie, though, if this weren't coming at this time, as a movie, Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic. This is a great performance. In any other year, I would say it's almost a shoo-in for an Oscar nomination.
Wow.
But there's so many things going on right now, which I completely understand, that you walk out of this movie and you feel bad about the world. The world becomes a scarier place after seeing it, and that's not exactly a place a lot of people want to be in right now.
Richard Roper, who you know in the Sun-Times, said something along those lines. I mean, he said this movie doesn't glorify the violence or doesn't glorify violence. Would you agree with that?
I don't know that I necessarily agree with it. There's not a lot of violence. It's not sustained violence throughout where you're just hit over the head constantly. But the scenes that are violent are particularly violent. They're shockingly violent in some cases. I think the reason the violence hits you so hard in this film is that it's not a comic book movie. This is not like The Avengers or anything else we're used to seeing, because this is set it's Gotham City, but it's basically New York in the 80s, and it feels very real. Joker or Arthur Fleck doesn't have any powers, so this is not a guy where, you know, a movie where things are fantastical, where it's not a world you can recognize. This feels very much of this world right now, and that's why when the violence comes, and like I said, they use it sparingly, but when it comes, it's pretty shocking.
It is the Joker, though, if you will, from Batman, right? I mean, if you're following a narrative, it's that guy, right?
Correct. This is the origin story of Joker and how he becomes to be how he gets set on the road towards becoming a supervillain. It is set in the Batman world. There are some characters that you might recognize from that world. And if you're somewhat familiar with the story, and I think, you know, a lot of people are, you're going to recognize some of those themes and some of those things from Batman. But it is not, you know, it's a superhero movie like we've never seen before, because we just don't usually see a very hard R-rated movie like this.
So give me the thumbnail sketch, though. He's a kid. He's a young man. He's taking care of his mother. He wants to be a clown. He's bullied and made fun of. Is there something that tips him or trips him into this psychotic violence?
Yeah, society beats him down, and, you know, he's an outcast. He's a character with mental problems. He gets picked on. He's different. And, you know, that's where this story is kind of tough for a lot of people, because we've been used to seeing over the past few years, especially, stories of people who are different, who persevere, and they become heroes in their stories. In this one, you have someone who's different, someone who's picked on, and picks the other path. He goes down a very different and very violent road. And that's where the comparisons are coming for when it comes to mass shooters and things like that. Because in society, in actual real society, we've seen this narrative over and over again with these shootings and violent acts of somebody who feels like they are an outcast from society, who feels that they are picked on and stepped on, and they turn to violence. And we've seen that so many times in these manifestos when we dig into the histories of these people on Facebook and things like that. Here you have a movie where that's the main character, and I can understand why a lot of people would not want to see that. Now, the question is, does this glorify this character? Is this guy made out to be not a superhero, but is somebody you sympathize with, somebody who's empathetic? That's a choice you're going to have to make as a moviegoer. I'm not going to make that for you, but I can see how that argument can be made.
By the way, I mentioned Dean Richards, who I thought was going to review it for the first time tomorrow, but several of you have texted into Producer Elephant and said Dean gave it an A+. Did you score it 1 to 4 stars or A to F? How did you score it, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do scores like that. I'll just tell you, it's a very, very good movie. I think acting wise, like I said, Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic. I think the cinematography is great. I think it looks very good. I mean, there are some shots that are just absolutely classic type cinema shots. This is a movie where if it didn't come out in this day and age, where we're comparing it to all these things that are going on in society right now, yeah. If you were evaluating this just as a movie, it's a great movie. It really is. It held my attention the whole time. It's a little bit slow in parts, but it never really felt slow to me. I was engrossed by this character, and I'm somebody who, you know, the Batman movies are okay. My favorite character, one of my favorite characters ever on screen, is probably Heath Ledger's Joker. I think that character is so fantastic, and for somebody to try to live up to that, I thought was going to be an almost impossible task, and Joaquin Phoenix almost gets there. I think Heath Ledger did such an amazing job, but maybe it was such a great job because he was in that movie for not, you know, it wasn't sustained for 2 hours, which, like you said, is tough to do. But Joaquin Phoenix is, you know, fantastic in this.
Did you see the Joaquin Phoenix Jimmy Kimmel interview?
I did, yes. The fake interview with the fake movie clip that they showed, I did see that.
Oh, well, so what was that all about? Because I was watching it in our office, and what I was looking at was Kimmel and him talking, and then they cut away to him saying disparaging things about the director, and then they go back to him, and he maybe was feigning or acting like, boy, this is really awkward and uncomfortable. And I thought, if this is real, Kimmel shouldn't be doing that. That whole thing was shtick?
Yeah, the whole thing was shtick. I emailed his publicist yesterday and asked, you know, for some clarification on it, and was told that it was a joke clip. So he wasn't really yelling at, it was the director of photography, Larry Scher. Either he wasn't really yelling at him, or there was something that they had set up. But, you know, Joaquin Phoenix has a history of going on talk shows and pulling pranks and doing things. He did a good job. He's a good actor because he did a good job. It seemed awkward and uncomfortable.
Oh, it was very awkward and uncomfortable. And here's the weird thing, though. I thought, this is not like Jimmy Kimmel. Like, Jimmy would read this room and back off, but he kept grinding on that thing as though, wow, there's this bad blood between you and the director, and calling him out by name. Phoenix is sweating and he's going, I this is a private moment. I don't want to talk about my craft that way. And I thought, yeah, this guy's kind of tortured here. Leave him alone. That was a bit.
Well, and that's one of the big clues right there, because if you do know Jimmy Kimmel and you're familiar with his show, he's very nice to guests.
Yeah.
He's not the kind of guy who wants to, because it's his job to get these people on his show every night. And so if he becomes known as the guy who's going to surprise guests with something that, you know, should have been kept private, he's going to lose a lot of his guests. So yes, the whole thing was a bit.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Jason. You do good stuff, man. Thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Sure thing. Take care.
Jason Nathanson, ABC Entertainment reporter. All right, Elif, so that explains that. Maybe you saw the clip, maybe you didn't. Elif was like, well, of course, that's what the publicist is going to say, but that was a genuinely awkward moment between the director and the star, and Kimmel was just mining it for comedy, and it was dying on the vine.
But you know what, though? You're right. Jimmy Kimmel wouldn't do that.
That's to me, that's the tip, right?
He seems like a genuine, well, I mean, you never know, but from the other side of the camera, but he seems like a genuine person.
No, I believe Kimmel's a good guy. I buy everything he's selling. And so that was not very Kimmel-ish right there.
And someone also from the 630 area code said, you do know Joaquin Phoenix isn't a nice person, don't you?
I don't know anything about Joaquin Phoenix.
But he does do the bits. I forgot about that.
Yeah, he's kind of a character actor, you know, even when he's not in a movie. It's a 248. Where is the jury on this? So Ken Griffin gives $125 million to our revered Museum of Science and Industry. It's now going to be called the Kenneth C. Griffin Museum of Science and Industry. Are you going to call him that? I asked this to the Mincing Rascals. Are you going to call it that? You should call him that. And I don't mean to look askance at $125 million for one of our great institutions. Thank you, sir. Thank you to the foundation. Thank you to your family. Whoever pulled the strings on that, and it sounds like it's him, thank you. That's what you should do with your billions of dollars. And he has tens of billions of dollars. He's the Citadel founder. So he's got money, but he's giving a lot of it away. The bike path along the lakefront, that's his, and I use it all the time. So God bless him for giving $125 million to that museum. But I said to the gang, the essence of philanthropy to me is a gift. It's not branding, you know. And I know that when you do give money, you sometimes get the right to have the building or something named after you. But if I give $125 million, listen to this, to the Museum of Science and Industry, I'm like, no, it's a gift. You don't have to call your name your museum after me. Just have the money. You know, maybe a little plaque in the corner. That's
yeah, a little statue off to the
just
side.
Just a little thing over there. You know,
big.
I mean, really, how much more happiness, joy, or stroke of the ego do I need now that I'm one of the richest people on earth? I'm worth tens of billions of dollars.
If it was you, all you need is your jeweled crown, and then you're fine.
I know, said a guy who wants to be king someday. But really, so I'm like, put it this way. If every time somebody said the Museum of Science and Industry, they said the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry, I would feel that was gratuitous. And, you know, that would just be a little too fawning for me. This is just my reaction to it, and I don't know what it's like to be a billionaire and give $125 million away. Maybe I'd want the stamp on that. But I'm resisting this. I don't like it. What do you say?
Can I repeat something that a very wise journalist in our newsroom had pointed out to us before?
Well, that's not Bertrand, but go ahead.
It was Ryan Burrow. He says that the Field Museum, the Shedd Aquarium,
yep,
and the Adler Planetarium are all named after people.
There's a Pritzker Pavilion in a park downtown, and it's lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. 312-981-7200. Your thoughts. Thanks again to Jason Nathanson from ABC for joining us, the entertainment reporter, talking about that movie, The Joker, or Joker, this weekend. If you go see it, call me or text me next week and let me know what you thought about it. And again, Richard Roper and Ro Khan talk about it in a little while as well with Anna DeVellantis. I'll tell you something that Brendan and I watched last night. You know, I said, you know, we need to find a new series to dive into. So we went over to Netflix and we watched the first episode of Unbelievable, which is a series based on a true story of a series of sexual assaults that took place and the women cops that resolved it. These detectives were really smart and figured it out. We watched the entire series last night. We put it on about 7 o'clock and I looked up, it was 2 in the morning. So, well, we got to go to bed now. We did the whole thing last night.
I'm shocked.
It's amazing. It's you just go, oh, next one, click, next one.
I couldn't sleep after 10 minutes of watching the first episode.
It's I'll tell you what, the first half of the first episode, I thought, I'm not going to watch this because it dwells so much on the sexual assault.
It's like, okay.
I know.
What about the victims that are watching it?
I know.
Sorry.
I know. No, that's a fair reaction. And then it gets away from that. And then, you know, it's a kind of whodunit and how they're going to, it's very much about the investigative process, and it's fascinating. So that's Unbelievable. That's the name of the series. It's on Netflix. Should they change the name of the Museum of Science and Industry to the Kenneth C. Griffin Museum of Science and Industry? 125 mil. Michael, you're on WGN Radio. What did you want to say? Hi.
I agree with you. He does donate the money to it, and I see it prevalently all over. I went to Lake Forest Academy, and the female dorm is named after the Fields family. The gymnasium is named after the Robert Crown family. Science is named after the Reyes family. Where it comes is particularly at Lake Forest and other places, the men's dorm was named after a Vietnam vet, won the Silver Star, killed in action, and a family member donated money for the new men's dorm, and they changed it to that, forgetting Mr. Bates had been named for that dorm for 30 years.
Oh.
You look at Stroger Hospital, you look at Mr. Duchessois, where I live up here in Barrington, goes donates a lot of money to the University of Chicago. It's okay that you put a big picture on the wall and everything else, and I understand the Lurie family with her working there.
Yeah,
and
how all about that?
But the thing is I do agree with you that certain institutions shouldn't be named just because you give a lot of money. There's a lot of people like the Walgreens and other people that have donated a lot of money to a lot of families and institutions in the Chicagoland area, and you don't see Walgreens or Wrigley's on every hospital or every organization. They've donated a lot of money as well.
Thanks for the phone call, Mike. Glad you joined us.
Thank you.
You betcha. Have a good day. Hey, Edward, you're on WGN Radio. What do you want to say?
Well, I think it's kind of a paradox, John. The original founder who donated the original money for the museum was Julius Rosenwald, who was the CEO of Sears Roebuck and became a very noted Chicago philanthropist. And actually, for a while, I guess there was his name was attached to it, but the family had to remove because he wanted to be an anonymous donor. And so I think it's kind of ironic that here the individual responsible for that great institution is not going to get credit, but the person who gave more money or later gave money is. Kind of reminds me of what happened in Northwestern when Dyke Stadium became Ryan Field.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Thank you for the phone call. We actually, somebody brought that up in the Mincing Rascals podcast. We said, well, you know, so then they sometimes put the stadium in the field inside the stadium, inside the park. You can get sometimes a lot of naming rights out of one place. I'm out of time. We'll do this again tomorrow. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, get ready to entertain you. That's coming up next.